This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Good evening. This is the 26th annual symposium on the presidency here at Berkeley, sponsored by the Institute of Governmental Studies at the University of California at Berkeley. Those of you who have been to or watched earlier versions of this event will note one difference this year. Nelson Polsby, one of the most distinguished political scientists in the world, was instrumental in founding this series and was our lone permanent panelist. Unfortunately, Nelson passed away unexpectedly earlier this spring, and I think it's fair to say for all of us who work on this program and for all of us at the Institute of Governmental Studies, his contributions will be very much missed this year and going forward into future years. But if there's one thing I know, it is that Nelson would want us to continue to argue and talk and debate about politics, and so on we'll go. The panel this year is terrific. Let me briefly introduce the panelists, and then we'll get started. As always, this will be kind of a freewheeling roundtable discussion. I don't think anybody here will stand on ceremony. I hope not. I hope they'll jump in and say what they want to say. To my far left is Fred Greenstein, who is professor of politics emeritus at Princeton University and the director of the program in leadership studies at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. His books include The Hidden Hand Presidency, Eisenhower as Leader, How Presidents Test Reality, and The Presidential Difference, Leadership Style from FDR to George W. Bush. He is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and past president of the International Society for Political Psychology. He received his BA from Antioch College and his PhD from Yale. To my near left is James Caesar, who is professor of politics at the University of Virginia, where he has taught since 1976. He has written several books on American politics and political thought, including Presidential Selection, Liberal Democracy and Political Science, Reconstructing America, and Nature and History in American Political Development. Professor Caesar has held visiting professorships at the University of Florence, the University of Basel, Oxford University, and the University of Bordeaux. And he is a frequent contributor to the popular press and often comments on American politics for the Voice of America. He was educated at Kenyon College and Harvard. To my immediate right is Susan Page. Susan is the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. She has covered six presidential elections and four administrations and is a past president of the White House Correspondents Association. She has appeared regularly as a commentator on CNN and elsewhere. Among her many awards are the Gerald R. Ford Prize for Distinguished Reporting on the Presidency and the Merriman Smith Award for Deadline Reporting on the Presidency. She is a graduate of Northwestern and of Columbia. And to my far right is Jack Citrin, who is a professor of political science here at Berkeley and associate director of the Institute of Governmental Studies. Jack's writings include American Identity and the Politics of Multiculturalism, Tax Revolt, and How Race, Ethnicity, and Immigration Shape the California Electorate. He was educated at McGill and here at Berkeley, and he has taught at Berkeley since 1969. During that time, he's held appointments as director of the State Data Program, acting director of the Survey Research Center, and faculty director of the Berkeley Washington Program. So I think in looking at the presidency over the last year and the political environment over the last year, the biggest news is obviously the Democratic victory in the fall elections and the Democratic takeover of Congress, and this has meant that the president faces a reinvigorated opposition, the first opposition Congress he's had in his presidency. So let me begin by asking Susan, who covers Washington on a regular basis, how has the president done in responding to this? What sort of strategy has he taken? How well has it worked? What's been his answer to this new environment?
Certainly is a changed world for the president. You have to look no farther than the last 2 days when we saw first the House and today the Senate pass funding for the Iraq war with these deadlines, which he has vowed to veto. It'll just be a second veto of his presidency, and quite a challenge to him that he's going to be seeing over and over again from this Democratic-controlled Congress. And I think the president, I do think President Bush at this point is more embattled and isolated than any president during the time I've been in Washington since 1979, those four presidencies I've covered, more embattled, I'd say, even than President Clinton was during the time of impeachment, which was clearly a very difficult time for President President Clinton, but President Bush finds himself in a situation where he's now in his seventh month of presidential approval ratings below 40%. That's the worst of any president since Jimmy Carter. He has more than an adversarial relationship with Democrats in Congress. And while Republicans in Congress continue to kind of held with him in these votes in the last 2 days, there is a lot of unease about the direction of the country and of the Iraq war in particular. President Bush has not changed his style of governing or his tactics in response to this, to the surprise of many of us. For instance, Alberto Gonzalez, still Attorney General, despite calls by many people in Washington, including some of President Bush's allies, to get rid of him. And, you mentioned I'm a former president of the White House Correspondents Association. Our notorious dinner was last Saturday, and I spoke with President Bush at the reception before the dinner, and he was talking to the person next to me, not to me, but he said that he continues to be feel confident that the next president, once that person is in office, will understand more about the decisions he made and that he'll be vindicated and the policies he's pursued will be vindicated. So his own confidence does not seem to be shaken, even as he finds himself really quite an isolated figure.
There's some appropriateness to comparing the Bush and the Truman presidencies, but it isn't as positive as the Bush people would like to have you believe when they say, here's this man who's remembered as a very distinguished president, but had difficulties. Other parallels which they don't mention are that, in fact, Truman seemed to be, in the early period of his presidency, seemed to be very imperfectly prepared for the presidency. And he was derided phrases like, this particular mess would not have happened if the president was alive, meaning FDR, or to error is Truman. Well, then there was a crisis, not 9/11, but the incipient communist triumph in Europe, and there was a sense of someone who had moved into the role and suddenly become more competent, who had stepped up to the bat, and what emerged was the Marshall Plan and the Truman Doctrine. Still, he was in difficulty by the end of his unelected term, which was very close to 4 years, because FDR died almost immediately after being elected for his forced term, ran on a very ambitious agenda, and in Truman's case was unexpectedly elected in his own right. But it was a disastrous second term, and it was not only disastrous because he was some very brave person who did all sorts of impressive things. It was partly disastrous because he and his people did not press to enact his program immediately after he was reelected, but lots of things turned against him that often happen in second terms. There were many episodes of charges of corruption, some of which ended in members of his administration and White House staff winding up in prison. There then was an American intervention in a war, and this was the Korean War. That became bitterly stalemated. The first year of the Korean intervention was drastically mismanaged, in this case by allowing General MacArthur to push all the way up to the Chinese border, and the absence of the intelligence was better than the actual practice, and the Chinese poured in, and MacArthur finally had to be fired. Truman spent the remainder of his presidency, the final 2 years, with even lower approval levels. So I think there is a parallel, but it doesn't always work to Bush's advantage to draw it out.
And in fact, Truman faced a divided government and an opposition Congress during his first term, not during his second. So in that sense, Bush faces a greater obstacle.
That's flipped. And the astonishing thing for was that Truman managed to get this foreign aid program known as the Marshall Plan enacted in the face. Truman Truman worked far more effectively as a bipartisan leader, but in that sense, it was rather like Bush in Texas. Bush in Texas, where he didn't perforce have to work with a Democratic legislature, seems like a very different creature than Bush in Washington.
I'd like to make 2 points. The first point is I don't exactly envy President Bush's position, but it's much better, I think, than most presidents in their second term. I did a small amount of research and looked at headlines in the New York Times in the week, comparable week of that we're facing today. Here's Clinton. Clinton is found to be in contempt of Jones' lawsuit. That's what he faced, and that ultimately destroyed his presidency and led the vice president to run away from him in the next campaign. Ronald Reagan, inquiry by Walsh said to scrutinize high U.S. officials. Iran-Contra breaking at this time, North implicated. Lyndon Johnson, U.S. jets bomb Haiphong. 100,000 rally at UN against Vietnam War. FBI is watching anti-war effort, Johnson himself tells the American people. Martin Luther King comes out against Johnson. Woodrow Wilson, at this point the covenant is announced, which again led to the undoing of his presidency. And then, as you would expect, Herbert Hoover. Hoover at Rapidan catches 20 trout while the country's going to hell. So I'm not sure that Bush's position is really worse. I think it's comparable to these other presidents, if not better. But the second point I want to make is I don't think it really makes much difference. There's nothing that President Bush is going to be doing on the domestic side in the next 2 years anyhow. That has nothing to do with the legacy of his presidency, if it has one. Everything has to do with the outcome of events in Iraq, and nothing that Congress is going to do is going to prevent the president from prosecuting this war until the end of his term. So I think the situation may in some way be uncomfortable, but on the basics, he's set and in a pretty good position to see whether or not what he wants to do will work or not.
Let's talk about Iraq a moment, unless you want to jump in on generally where the president is and how he's responding.
Well, I want to build on what Jim just said, and given what happened to Don Imus recently, I'm not going to say the words that I want to say, but it does strike me that if you're elected president at some point in your tenure, a four-letter word, blank, 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 happens. And then the question is, how do you respond and how do you deal with that? And there's been a lot of talk about how Bush was inexperienced, he didn't know how to deal with Congress, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But Lyndon Johnson, who was the master politician who knew more than anyone else how to control Congress, essentially ended up in the same situation, the same fate, and even though he could have run for re-election, he decided not to run because the blank, 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 blank that happened to him was something that politically he could not overcome. So I think, you know, if we make a distinction between the president, whoever that person happens to be, and the presidency as an institution, and how does the presidency cope with the inevitable conflicts, problems, you know, things that history will throw up. That seems to me to be something we're thinking about since we are in our 26th year. We want to focus not just on the particular, but on the general. And if you think about the general, then what are the elements and what will the sort of impact of the Bush's presidency be on the presidency in general? And I think what's happening now, what from the long-term point of view is more interesting, it's not what's going to happen in the next year and a half. I completely agree with Jim that Bush is going to persist to the extent that he possibly can with his current course of action. There'll be an election, someone will be elected, Republican or Democrat, and that person will inherit a mess and have to deal with it. Fine. The question is really, what is going to be the outcome of the ongoing conflicts, really a separation of powers conflict between the presidency and other institutions over control of foreign policy, over access to information within the executive branch, and over individual rights. And those things are also have a long history in American politics. And to me, that's much more significant than the, you know, what's going to happen on this resolution that the Senate and the House passed. Because we know what's going to happen. It's passed. It's going to be vetoed. Some other kind of resolution will emerge. And in the end, you know, the troops will get their money and the war will go on for a while. And then the facts on the ground will dictate what happens.
You know, perhaps the difference between a journalist and a thinker, academic like yourself, that, of course, I live for the day-to-day. I'm reluctant to disagree with someone with a PhD after his name, but this is the second term I've covered in Washington, and it's certainly true that second terms always get in trouble for various reasons. You know, the chickens come home to roost, and you run out of ideas, and everybody's exhausted, but I do think this one is different and worse for the president than the previous two ones I've covered. Ronald Reagan, beginning of his second term, got this big tax reform package through a Democratic Congress. It was his major domestic program for his second term, and he got it done. And at the end of his second term, while he had the Iran-Contra scandal in the middle of his second term, did a lot with arms control with the Soviet Union, formed a partnership with Mikhail Gorbachev that changed the world. So I think that was from the perspective of where Bush is now, at least, a happier second term. And even Clinton, got into a scandal of his own making. It certainly weakened him and limited some of his ambitions. But embarked on this major Middle East peace initiative, which in the end did not come to fruition, but, you know, certainly reflected kind of the energy and ambitions of a presidency who is still in the game. This president is defined and overshadowed by the war in Iraq. Perhaps the war will turn around. Perhaps the surge will work. And if it does, he'll be vindicated. But if it's not, his presidency will be defined in a different way. And he's lost some of the other options I think he hoped to have. Social Security is a big initiative his second term. He acknowledged this week that's dead. Even immigration, which he wanted to achieve in his first term, it's possible something will happen on immigration. But this is not the presidency that George W. Bush had hoped to have.
Let's talk about Iraq for a moment, because I think it combines both the immediate and the long-term tension between the branches that Jack was talking about. Here's a case where there is currently tension between the role of the executive and the role of the legislative branch. Let's take the sort of practical outcome first. What is likely to happen in Washington on the war resolutions over the next few months?
Well, Jack is exactly right. They'll fight about it. President Bush will veto it. They'll then come back and pass some short-term funding resolutions to continue financing the war. But this is a fight we're going to see happen over and over again. And it's a tactic by Democrats to force Republicans in Congress and the president to continue to defend a war that's become increasingly unpopular.
And does anybody up here think that it reflects any, will there be any substantial change, or is there any interesting dynamic here in the relationship of the branches as they struggle over who should manage the war? Fred?
It looks to me as if Bush has dug in. Initially, in some of the things he said and the kind of buoyant way he responded to taking a thumping, as he put it, he opened that press conference by saying, why so many glum faces? So you had that kind of bouncy quality that is kept for a long time. He seems very tired and bitter and hard and dug in at this point. And that, incidentally, was kind of a Truman thing. This was the period when Truman wrote his angry letter to the music critic and stuck relentlessly behind people who had accepted mink coats and deep freezes and not just done lousy jobs testifying before Congress. But I think in all of these presidents is where right or wrong, wise or not, necessary or not, the president's in charge and there is a stalemated war and it's going nowhere, that's the dominant thing, and it's going to cast an enormous pall. the person who sounded as if he might go to war, Reagan, who talked about an evil empire and so on, being a good actor, he pivoted. He worked very well with the Democrats on that tax thing. They did quite a good job, and he had help on this from a number of people to dig out of that Iran-Contra thing. And I would even go beyond what Susan said, or just amplify it at another level. Bonding with Gorbachev was extraordinarily impressive. And each of those four summits, there were four meetings with the first person, it's sometimes said, the first Soviet leader who weighed more than his wife. I mean, this young guy in his 50s. Bonding with Gorbachev led to a step-by-step.
Better be careful, Fred. You're in Berkeley now. We got
stop when
the
I
obesity
get.
Police are.
Oh well, okay.
They're going to come down on you.
Or the Russian embassy, I'm afraid.
Well, yeah.
Well, you didn't. You skipped your Imus moment, so I've had mine, but only in Berkeley would.
That's
that
why
be.
Your mic doesn't work. You know?
Oh well, I must be on the no talk list, so I'll shut up.
Jim, does this reflect any change in the role of the two branches, or is this a common stalemate? Whenever there's a war, the president says he's the commander-in-chief, the Congress says they have the power of the purse. Is this current stalemate a typical stalemate between the branches?
I don't know whether it's typical, but I agree that we're not going to see the Congress effectively cut off funding. They did it in Vietnam, so it's in that case, the Democrats were willing to go to the plank and jump. I don't think they're going to do it this time. So that's a huge difference. They have the power. They're not going to exercise it. But I did want to say something about this. The Democrats also are a little bit the victim of this situation. They were supposed to have a very broad agenda coming out of the 2006 election. Can anyone name what their agenda is besides opposition to Iraq? It's consumed them more or as much as the president. So where are the Democrats today? Where's the positive agenda? I believe by the end of the year, the Democrats will be begging the president to go along to make a deal on immigration. They'll need it more than him. What is it that they've accomplished? They sent out their Secretary of State, Nancy Pelosi. She went to Damascus, and it was a disastrous performance. They have a weak reed in the Senate. Where are they today? They are going to need something as well out of this two-year period when they came in with all these great expectations. And the war, it could be a trap for them as much as for the president. I also want to say, for the president's point of view, he's faced a little bit more adversity in the past than one would think and come out of it. I remember after his election in 2000, he was very low in the polls, and people thought he would roll over and make deals with the Democrats on the Democrats' terms. He didn't, and he succeeded. And the same thing happened after the Senate went into the hands of the Democrats. You recall that when the Democrats captured control of the Senate when Jim Jeffords switched. Again, he went on the offensive. This role of being not in control of Washington is not as unfamiliar to him as many believe. Of course, I agree the whole outcome is not in his hands. It's dependent upon what happens somewhere halfway across the world. And the fate of his presidency is in the events there. He gambled his whole presidency on that point. He's lost up till now. Who knows what will happen?
Do you agree, Susan, that the Democrats are likely to need some sort of domestic policy achievement as much as the Republicans over the next year?
Well, I think that Democrats would like to have something to show. Minimum wage, maybe some action on health care. So yes, I think I would agree that a completely opposition agenda is not enough. But it is kind of the lion's share of what Democrats want to do. And if Democrats effectively make a case against the war, which is George Bush's war, that can take them a long way in a presidential election. I mean, if you think about, for instance, since the 1980 election, which was the first election I covered. Ronald Reagan's basic message was he was not Jimmy Carter. And people were really fed up with Jimmy Carter. And that was, it wasn't that people bought into all of Reagan's positions. In fact, there was a lot of discomfort with some of Reagan's positions, but they were fed up enough with the team that was in charge that they were willing to kind of take a leap of faith with Ronald Reagan. And I think in some ways Democrats hope that they aren't going to be in a, they are going to be in a similar situation next year when it comes to the presidential election. When it comes to the congressional elections, you know, Democrats are very well positioned to continue to hold the Senate and increase their numbers in the Senate next year because there are a lot more Republicans up for election. And the House, you know, more closely divided, So I guess I agree with you, but not. But I do think that the just as the war dominates Bush's agenda, it's going to be opposition to the war that is the front and center for Democrats.
One of the things to say about the Bush presidency, since in the light of Iraq and all of the errors made on that, it seems like extreme incompetence, that at other levels there has been a high degree of political professionalism with a very narrow Republican majority. There was great success in mobilizing it for extremely controversial tax cuts. Then, rather unexpectedly, and almost as if Dr. Jekyll had become Mr. Hyde, Bush collaborated with Teddy Kennedy on an education bill, which is controversial and complex, but which has now come to be a kind of a central edifice. It's something which is being progressively and incrementally modified rather than just being discarded. And it's an attempt to do something about an education system which is not working terrifically well by international standards and is working particularly poorly for minority groups. And so here's two major pieces of legislation. Of course, lots of things were done in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. Now, to say that none of this is great because it doesn't fit Jack's shortlist, it's fine for Jack, but it's a little bit like having a PhD qualifies him to say, look at the Rocky Mountains as if he were an astronaut, and they look like a bare ripple. But if you're at the bottom of these mountains and looking up, they look pretty big. And I think a surprising amount has come out and things have happened which undoubtedly do fit your four-letter summary, like an optional war. But they also have guaranteed this particular president a lot of pages in the history books.
Do you disagree with Jack's practical point that Jack's point for the short term was nothing's going to happen?
For the next 2 years?
For the remainder of the Bush presidency.
Well, the war is going to continue.
Well, sure. The domestic policy.
I don't see how you can tell at this point. I think it's not just a matter of making a record for the 2008 election, but there are all sorts of forces at work. And one sign of a certain amount of suppleness on Bush's part is the way he's proceeding on immigration. There was a press conference, which you undoubtedly covered, where he was lauding Senator Kennedy as someone who's really on top of this issue and the lead Democrat and so on. So on the immigration matter, which is certainly a problematic issue in that the economy needs immigrants to operate, but the whole notion of amnesty and so on is fraught with all kinds of emotionalism. My guess is on that one, pieces will fit together, and then on some other things. But Susan is close to those issues. She looks at the Rocky Mountains from ground level and not from Jack's level.
You know, I think it's possible.
This is why he got his PhD from Yale. I just wanted to.
That's right.
That's a real PhD. I have Berkeley PhD.
The topic of my dissertation was back torque.
Let's not get into a Yale-Berkeley argument, Susan.
You know, I think it's possible there'll be a deal on immigration, and that's not unimportant. But I agree with Jack that when you think about the big issues like 45 million Americans without health insurance or the peril faced in the future by Medicare and Social Security, those are issues that are really too big to address with a weakened presidency, a war going on, and a Congress that's trying to score points.
You just said weakened presidency, and that's interesting to me because there have been arguments by many that Bush has increased presidential power or has at least attempted to increase presidential power on a wide variety of issues. Do any of you think that he actually has increased the power of the presidency, or is that a canard? Well, let me start there. Is that
There's certainly a lot of steps he's taken to try to do that, signing statements and put his vision of his version of what a bill actually means, refusing to cooperate with Congress, for instance, not releasing the names of the people that the Cheney Energy Task Force met with, and a whole series of things. After that was before 9/11. After 9/11, certainly he's taken a lot of steps that have gotten less public attention, but have been aimed very much at strengthening the institution of the presidency. And this is a special pet project of Dick Cheney, who was chief of staff for Gerald Ford at the point many of the powers of the presidency were being kind of chipped away by Congress.
Jack, has Bush successfully increased the power of the presidency, the institution?
I defer to maybe Jim wants to say something. I think all I would say is that I agree with Susan that the sort of the boundaries of executive power is something that is an issue that has emerged more starkly in this presidency, although I think it's inherent, it's latent always in the separation of powers argument. The battles over executive privilege, the War Powers Resolution Act, all of these things emerged in the context of congressional pushback against Johnson and Nixon, and this is, it's not a replay, but there's some of the same elements, I think, going on here.
Jim, has there been an increase in this?
Well, there was, as long as people thought there was a war and that the war was legitimate. I think the beginning of this was Bush making this declaration of calling this thing a war, which I recall when this happened. What were we going to call 9/11? What were we going to call the reaction? I think the most important moment of Bush's presidency was calling what happened a war, and making that stick initially. And that had continued up through, I would say, 1 year after the 2004 election, that a large part of the American people believed that not only this was a war, but it was a legitimate war. The problem now is we're exactly in the situation of late 1960s, is a large part of the American people do not believe, first of all, that this is a war. They know that we're in a war in Iraq, but they don't believe that there's a real war, long-term war against terror. They don't believe that that's how to define the situation. So a portion of the president's legitimacy on this issue is in dispute. It's disputed by a whole political party. And inevitably, now that that party has the majority, it's pushing back. It's not granting the lease or the leash. And so Bush was able to increase the power for a number of years, and now it's inevitable that it will be curtailed somewhat. Not enough to prevent him from another few months of this war, but we're clearly in a different situation politically, and the American people yet haven't made up their mind. We're, two parties have a different view of the world. Two parties have a different view of the challenge. Two parties have a different view of the future. It's coming out in stark relief. In my view, stark relief is what we found in 1972.
Your view then is that to whatever degree Bush increased the power of the presidency, it was really temporary. It was not institutional or systemic. It was based on the political situation at the moment, and now that political situation has changed,
there's a reaction. I mean, every president during a war where the war is regarded by both parties as a legitimate war is going to get a longer leash. And now we face a situation since 2004. where the Democratic candidate was largely against the war. Certainly the one who moved the politics in 2004, Howard Dean, was against it, didn't believe that the situation was accurately portrayed. And now with the congressional election, you have one party that denies this premise. So you begin now to shorten the leash. And I think this is pretty much how our system has worked all along. Nothing unexpected on this point.
Has the president's sort of insistent style on that, is that going to spark a backlash in Congress? That is to say that for years the president has been so insistent and so, insistent expanding presidential or articulating presidential authority. Has that, just at a sort of personal level in Congress, sparked a desire now to restrict the power of the president?
Well, it's certainly a lot more pushback now by Democrats. And in fact, even some Republicans in Congress have been concerned about the expansion of executive powers. I just want to say one thing about the choice of the word war after 9/11. A colleague of mine at USA Today just last week did an interview with Ari Fleischer, who was press secretary for President Bush on 9/11. And he said that on the day of September 11th, there was a discussion in the White House about what to call what had just happened. And that the White House wanted to call it a war, but weren't sure that this would be widely accepted, just the point you made. And that they were greatly reassured when the headlines in papers the next morning said things like, the USA Today headline said, act of war. Many other headlines across the country did the same thing. And that reinforced that this was a word that they could use, the word that they wanted to use, and that Americans generally would accept it. So wasn't exactly your question, but I thought your point was interesting because that was exactly the debate, Ari said, going on behind the scenes on September 11th.
And when did that, but that really changed then with the beginning of the Iraq War and people's turning against that and seeing that as a separate war, correct? That then came to
now,
be seen, yeah.
Now, right. now it's seen as two wars. Of course, initially with the Iraq War, it was seen as a seamless garment of war, but no longer, I think, generally seen that way.
Let's go on to a current domestic issue, which is in a way minor and fleeting, but which I think I'm curious if the panelists think it reflects the president's leadership style, and that is the Alberto Gonzalez flap or scandal, whatever one wants to call it. Does it reflect something about the president's style?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Bush is strong enough to get rid of Gonzalez right now. If he were stronger, he might. But obviously, he's not in a strong position, and to give up Gonzalez would only feed the Democrats.
Absolutely.
So he's holding on to him not because Gonzalez has proved himself to be particularly competent, that's for sure. Although we can remember two other words, Janet Reno.
My question really on Gonzalez is, does it reflect, is Bush holding on to him in part because of a personal style in which he, to quote from Fred's quotation, makes a decision and sticks with it, that he will not back down?
Well, he will get rid of people from time to time. He was first Treasury Secretary, finally get rid of, I keep wanting to say McNamara, but it's Rumsfeld. Yeah.
But it does appear, and I, you know, from all of the accounts of him, the loyalty and sticking by the team is a value that he has. I mean, you know, I think this Gonzalez thing is kind of interesting, and they go back together a long way, right? So it's one of those things. But, you know, the greatest movie ever made is The Godfather, and my favorite scene in The Godfather is when the Corleones are battling with the Salucis, and they're waiting for their enforcer, Luca Brasi, to show up, and there's a phone call, and sort of Sonny Corleone says, "Where is Luca Brasi?" And there's a phone call, and the message at the other end of the phone call is, "Luca Brasi sleeps with the fishes." And basically, Alberto Gonzalez sleeps with the fishes, whether he knows it or not.
To go on to other things while you are doing that, I wanted to talk a little bit about the effect that the president is going to have, has had on the 08 campaign. Susan, let me start with you. Has he put the Republicans in a serious hole for 08?
What's the effect of his presidency on the campaign?
You know, it's hard for the party to hold a White House for a third term. It's only happened for a third consecutive term. It's only happened once since World War II, and that was when a very popular Ronald Reagan helped elect the elder George Bush to one term. Bush, the current President Bush, is certainly in no position to do that for a possible successor. I think he has dug kind of a hole for the GOP. He's contributed to a landscape that looks pretty unfriendly for Republicans next year.
What's interesting is that at this point, none of the major candidates are running away from the president. You would think in the Republican Party, well, maybe you wouldn't, but you would think that there would be someone who would be running away from the president. In fact, if you look at the positions of the candidates on the war, they're either the same as the president or tougher. McCain's position is tougher than the president's, meaning more pro-Iraq. Giuliani's is about the same, and Romney's is about the same. How long can this continue? It shows that he hasn't. There's no distance between Bush and the other candidates, which is a rather remarkable thing. So they are the other candidates are as tied to the outcome of the war as the president is. I see no Republican, none of those three, having any chance of winning unless there's some light at the end of the tunnel appearing in Iraq. That they would be they've taken ownership of it. On the other hand, if there is some light at the end of the tunnel, they'll be in a very strong position in 2008.
Why don't you think anybody has run away from him? Sort of taken the Chuck Hagel route.
You've got to run in the Republican primaries, and the one if it is a demographic group, the one demographic group that's very positive about the Iraq intervention and about George W. Bush is Republicans. The independents are almost identical to Democrats at this point in the polls, but our between Democrats and Republicans, the system is more sharply polarized than it has been in the entire history of polling, which goes back to the 1930s. And so those people who are Republican voters have been very strong, and those are the ones who, you know, who vote in the Republican primary.
Do you attribute that polarization to President Bush?
No, because it's been progressive. There's a very good book on that. Actually, it is called A Divider, Not a Uniter, so it's very focused on it by Gary Jacobson of UC San Diego. But it's been quite linear. If you think about the division on the Clinton impeachment, that was Clinton was as much a blood pressure raiser in one portion of the population as Bush is in another portion.
And you don't think that polarization has increased? I mean, it has been increasing, but you don't see a particular increase.
I think the answer is that there is an increase, but it's a tide that has gone higher. It's a tide that was rising, and judging from Professor Jacobson's numbers, it's risen particularly rapidly, partly perhaps because of some of the things Susan referred to, the kind of in-your-face aspects of the governing style, except for certain occasions when in fact, Bush has been more like he was in Texas when he instantly befriended the Democratic leader in the legislature.
But I think when you come to the presidential election, I mean, there are two dimensions to it. There's a certain structural component to it, which is defined by the distribution of party identification. And so if you have 40% of the people or 35 on either side, which in the last few elections has been the case, you know, the Republicans would vote for Attila the Hun, and the Democrats would vote for, I don't know, Ho Chi Minh, whoever. Mass murderer versus serial rapist, but he's ours, you know, he's ours. And then there's the 20% in the middle who are going to be swayed by what? What are the sort of the people, the so-called swing voters, going to be swayed by? They're going to be swayed by two things, or two general categories of things. One is, how are things going? Is the country doing well or poorly? One, in war,
war is worse than peace, or at least a losing war is worse than peace, and prosperity is better than recession. Those are pretty easy judgments to make. And then the second judgment is about, you know, how do you feel about the candidates? Because it's a personal contest. Okay, so it's clear that if it were today, Bush is a big negative because the dominant issue being Iraq goes against him, and his personal popularity is low, and as Fred rightly said, it's low among independents. But the fact is that Bush is not going to be running, I don't think. As far as I can tell, he's not going to be running. So if it comes to Rudolph Giuliani, let's say, against Hillary Clinton, you know, you've got the distribution of party identification, which probably marginally favors the Democrats at this point. And you've got, then you've got how are things going in Iraq, which we don't know, as Jim says. And how are things going in the economy, which for the moment actually is going very well, as I just checked my stock report today. And then you've got Hillary Clinton versus X, or Obama versus Y. And those things are, at this point, we don't know what that's going to be. So I would definitely say that the structural situation, as everyone here says, and Bush is a big negative, he's a drag on the Republicans, and it's hard to see how that will change. But, you know, he's not going to be on the ballot, as far as I can tell. Maybe I'm wrong, because I only have a Berkeley PhD, not a Yale or Harvard PhD. But, you know, I don't think he's going to be on the ballot.
Does it change the dynamic that Cheney is not running? Obviously, it does in the sense that he's not in the race. But does that also change the dynamic of the administration by sort of emboldening them to do what they will to pursue this in-your-face governing style? Does it free them up from having to concern themselves with Cheney's political future?
You know, I think it does. I think if you had a vice president, more traditional vice president who was running for president, he would go to the president and say, you got to get rid of Alberto Gonzalez. It's killing me. Or you have to take the recommendations of the Iraq study group because otherwise I don't have any chance in this election. Cheney has played, you know, really the reverse role, which is, you know, screw those guys. We've got to hang firm. I don't know if history will tell us whether this has served President Bush well or ill to have this situation, but it is in a fundamental way different from that of most presidents. It also means we have these wide open contests on both sides, which we haven't had since 52 or 28.
Except the presidents actually have not consistently been generous to their vice presidents,
true.
And
this
certainly
true.
Was the case with Johnson and Humphrey, and at all stages in their relationship, and even Reagan, in a sense, the interesting thing when, as you remember, when George H.W. came in, they had this long pause, and late in the Reagan presidency, Bush actually went public saying he thought the Cold War wasn't over yet.
And the same thing with Eisenhower was certainly no great help to Nixon, particularly.
Well,
that's got
a great anecdote
there.
Anecdote being when they asked what Nixon had done, he said, "Give me a week and I'll think about it."
When I was doing interviews, I asked John Eisenhower, the one surviving Eisenhower child, what his father was thinking of. He said, "I think Dad made a Freudian slip."
Fred, I wanted to ask you about something. I was reading your writing on Bush today, and in an overall or general sense about your thinking about the president, I sense that you thought that the president grew in a personal leadership sense after 9/11, but that subsequently his administration ran into problems because the decision-making process was very deeply flawed, mm-hmm. highly ideological, largely without internal debate. Is that a fair summary of what you see as the overarching theme of the administration?
Rather than responding minutely to your summary, put it this way. Bush seemed almost not to be a presence by the time September of his first year rolled around, and his numbers, which were never high compared, say, with Kennedy coming in with almost a 50-50 election and immediately ratcheting up to 70% approval, and even with the disaster of the Bay of Pigs actually going up further at that point, Bush had slip down to the 50% mark, then at least by Gallup numbers, ratcheted up to a record 90 within the month. I thought he did not look very strong the night of 9/11. He'd been dragged around the country, and he seemed kind of quavery, which is the first time he'd spoken for the Oval Office, and he had not yet given a press conference. But within the week, he had his bullhorn moment at Ground Zero. He was very eloquent and moving at the National Cathedral. A month to the day, he gave a press conference where every evidence was that he was on top of his game and knew a lot and kept sort of, every time he thought he'd stop answering a question, he would start again and go further. Then, of course, you have the axis of evil and the movement and the temporary break in that, going to the UN, which was something that Cheney had publicly opposed. But that's an example. What happened at the point that they went to the UN was an example of what seems to be, particularly in retrospect, a dysfunctional policymaking process in that Powell, who for whatever reasons, this extraordinarily popular figure, whose life had consisted of working highly effectively in bureaucracies, who had insisted on using major force levels with the first Bush law, first Gulf War. Powell in this administration was very polite, and as one, his biographer, Karen DeYoung puts it, very soldierly and staying within the lines and so on. But at that point, he arranged to meet alone or with Condi Rice and the president and persuaded him to go to the UN. And that's a sign now, and the DeYoung book, which is based on a lot of interview time on the record with Powell, shows the extent to which particularly Cheney was preempting things and pushing things in one way or another. There is a kind of political science code, which probably is simplistic, but it is a notion that the decisions are best made if you have a wide canvas of information. If you look at the downsides, the questions, the disagreements, you get it all stated very clearly and debated within the councils of the administration with everyone present and nobody back channeling. And in fact, when Jack talked about rising to the general, I first thought about Eisenhower. And the Eisenhower decision-making process included weekly meetings of the NSC in which there was a focused and rigorous agenda and sometimes parallel columns listing who agreed and who disagreed on everything. The two things that strike me about the Bush process is, first of all, it has left a lot of room for back-channeling, and it's put a great premium on bureaucratic sharp elbows, and both Cheney and Rumsfeld, who of course go back and are very close to each other, are consummate and ruthless bureaucratic operators. And the other thing is that part of Bush's management mantra is that he doesn't micromanage, and also he doesn't do nuances. So he wants simple decisions. In Texas, he stripped down his decision-making process, cut down the time he spent on death sentence appeals. When he had a major report on the Texas A&M bonfire disaster, it was known that he didn't read it and didn't even read the executive summary, but only some highlighting. In many ways, he's a good politician, but he doesn't seem to be a good politician in working with this great complex American bureaucracy. And some of the things that people joked about with Kennedy, the way Kennedy would actually telephone some bureaucrat at the CIA or a desk person at the UN and say, well, you know, what's the real word on this? And, you know, here we are with Bush finally doing in a very wimpy way what many military professionals thought he should have done right away, which is a huge military presence and a lot of systematic planning for the Iraq intervention. So I think that's, you know, ironically, this is someone whose formal training is in management, but it's not the right kind.
The first MBA president.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, but just one small comment, and Fred knows so much more about this than I or than most people, anybody for that matter. What's interesting when you listen to this and you think about how these various presidents over the years have been evaluated, right? Jimmy Carter was the preeminent assistant secretary. He got involved in too many details. Ronald Reagan, so he failed. Ronald Reagan was too remote and distant. Bill Clinton couldn't make a decision, wanted to know everything. George Bush is too detached. And so it's kind of ironic in a way that we sit here and we say, okay, our concern as citizens is what would, is there some sort of set of rules that we can identify that would sort of guide, at least in a general way, an effective and successful presidency. And of course, there's no such, there's at one level there's the presidency, and on the level there's the president. And so Bush is the MBA style president with all of its flaws, and Jimmy Carter was the micromanager and with all of its flaws, and Bill Clinton was the whatever with all of its flaws. And so, you know, it's kind of as a little bit unsettling, frankly, and depressing that we go through these things talking about different presidential styles and we don't come up with any sort of set of rules. On that pessimistic note.
Let me ask Susan sort of the same question I asked Fred, which is the president's style. Is there a problem with a style that does not seem to value internal debate as much as some previous presidents?
You know, I think this is an example of something that initially the White House saw as a strength becoming perhaps a weakness as time has gone on. Because the Bush White House took a lot of pride in the fact that they have had very few leaks. Part of it is that premium on loyalty. But as Fred just said, a very closed decision-making process. So I think President Bush does not hear a lot of dissenting voices. I don't think he really wants to. And that means that he ends up with the policy he ends up with. You know, it's messier when you have a policy like the one Clinton had, where, you know, there was no end to the people he'd see, and there was no end to the leaks, and some chaos in the decision-making process. But at least you felt assured that when he got to the point of making a decision, he had heard a lot of different voices. I think as time has gone on, that's become a problem for Bush in a way that I think initially he thought this was a great asset of his presidency.
What he has that Clinton didn't have is tenacity and a checklist of things that he always wants at a particular time and that he is bulldog-like in pursuing. And you were at one point talked about the Monica thing and the impeachment destroying Bush's presidency. But Bush's...
Clinton's presidency.
I'm sorry, Clinton's, yeah, sorry. But Clinton's approval level was actually, the very highest approval level was the month that the impeachment was voted, if you read Bill Clinton's huge autobiography, which is the most undisciplined book on earth, you have a kind of an image of a president that goes this way and goes that way. So. No, there's no general rule, and you can't get a set of Lego blocks and put together a flawless president. And besides, things also depend on the context and events that the president can't take account of. But Bush has some strengths that would have been advantageous to other people, and some. But he has the weaknesses of his strengths. So he's focused and he has an agenda, but he's stubborn, and sometimes the agenda is counterproductive.
It's as old as the world. How can you put together the lion and the fox?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, perhaps by the time we do this panel again next year, we'll have a better idea and we'll review the whole presidency. Thank you to the panel, Fred Greenstein, Jim Caesar, Susan Page, Jack Citrin. Thank you and good night.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.